Good day, Vashon Mori Island. My name is March Twisdale, and I'm so glad you've joined us today here at our island's own Voice of Vashon on 101.9 FM, KVSHLP Vashon. You're listening to Prose, Poetry, and Purpose, a conversation-style interview show highlighting authors from around the world who seek in their own creative way to inspire all of us to be the best we can be. And now, on with the show. All right, so Melissa, thank you so much for joining me today. I'm really glad we made this happen.
Me too. Thank you for having me.
Yeah, so it's Melissa Welliver, correct?
That's me, yes.
So, Melissa, if you could ground yourself for our listeners for a second, give them a sense of who you are and what you do.
Yeah, of course. So my name's Melissa. I live in the UK. And my debut novel, The Undying Tower, will be out in September, an ebook in October, paperback. And I was a programmer for a few years in my family business until the pandemic hit, and I had to step back a little bit from that. And then I was lucky enough to sell a book, well, a trilogy of books. So that's where I am now. I also work for a writing online course place called Write Mentor. We do some free stuff. We do some accessibility stuff, and we try to be as affordable as possible. And mm-hmm. that is my background. So that's me.
Right, right. So, okay, I have to say, it's so interesting to hear someone actually mention that because of the pandemic, they had to step back from a computer programming job, given that many people have the impression that basically anything you can do on the computer has been a safety zone in the middle of the pandemic. So I'm a little confused by that.
Yeah. Okay. So I think, first of all, definitely we've all learned there was nothing safe, and all the stuff that you maybe thought was always a safe job wasn't necessarily suddenly. So my family's business works with payroll, and going into offices, installing payroll. And that was the bottom of the list when the pandemic hit and people had to work from home. So I ended up not, there just wasn't enough work for everyone in the family business. Mm-hmm. So I took a step back and focused more on the writing stuff. And it was tough. But I was really lucky. I have my partner's a teacher, so he was still working, and I was very supported by family, so I was okay. But it was tough not working really for quite a few months in the middle there before I found some freelance stuff with writing, such as editing and helping mentor other writers.
Right. Oh, absolutely. No, it's a great point. I had actually landed a new job in November of 2019, started training December and January, and then January and February, I started working the new job. And then March, my job was eliminated by city, state, and county.
Oh, wow.
And that was, they all said, no, you can't do that.
The triple whammy.
Yeah, right. I know. And eventually it came, the funny thing is, at the time, I was actually working this amazing woman who had an amazing customer base at farmers markets, which is like a primary way of bringing the produce, the food, the meats, everything from the rural country environment into the city to feed people. And what was interesting was that grocery stores, which are these indoor environments with circulated air and lots of people all coming into this closed space, you know, they were left open, but all the farmers markets were somehow relegated to being seen as like recreation or something, or an unnecessary. Oh, okay. And I'm like, we are outside where it's safer for not spreading a virus, you know, the wind's blowing past all of us and stuff, but no, they all got shut down pretty hard for a while there.
Yeah. Yeah. I think it depends place to place. I know the UK had some harsher parts and then some parts where we probably shouldn't have opened up as early as we did.
Yeah.
It's just been really a think for yourself. Think what is the safest thing that you could possibly do for you and everyone around you, isn't it?
Yeah.
It's been that kind of time.
Well, yeah, absolutely. And I actually dove into creating the Masks for Vashon project on the island with a couple of other amazing women. And then a whole bunch of volunteers stepped up, and it was just this beautiful community event, creating thousands and thousands of hand-sewn masks. So I'm all for being safe, and I still rarely go into public, but but my job went away. So yeah. I get that.
Yeah, that's tough. It's tough.
It is interesting, and yet it could be tougher.
Yes, that's very true. Yes, definitely could have been tougher. Definitely makes you think about what you do have.
Yeah. All right. So the Undying Tower, and there's no subtitle to that.
No. It's okay. Part of the Undying Trilogy.
Right.
This one's called The Undying Tower. Other titles, TBC.
I know. So let's go ahead. And I've got all sorts of cool things we're going to chat about. But I think let's dive into for my writers. Let's start there. So this is your debut, meaning what that means is literally you have not been published before.
No.
Okay.
I might have had a short story published in a pamphlet, and that's about it. Yeah.
Okay. And this is the first of a trilogy. So all sorts of writers out there are wondering right now in this moment, how did you land a trilogy with your, your first step out of the box, so to speak?
Yeah. Okay. So that's, first of all, an interesting point. It's not necessarily my first step out of the box. So I've had an agent since June 2017. Mm-hmm. And she was a great agent called Tessa David at Peters Fraser and Dunlop, which is quite an old established agency over here in the UK. And she signed me with a different book. And we revised that book for a few months. We went out in January 2018, I think it was. Mm-hmm. And that book did not sell. Mm-hmm. Didn't go anywhere. Just wasn't quite hitting the right tone. There was no real reason. It was, we all know, writers all right. know, it's 50% luck. So it just was not hitting the right desk at the right time. I'm not sure. Yeah. I then moved on to another project, which was this book, which actually was the first book, The Undying Tower's first book I'd ever finished, but I put aside because when I was querying it, it didn't go anywhere. Mm-hmm. And my agent said, you know what, there's somebody else at this agency that would be a better fit for this kind of book, dystopian, speculative, and more YA. My first one was more middle grade.
Right.
And so she stepped in, Lucy Irvine, so she's my fabulous agent now. And we worked on it and went out again in about, it must have been 2020. Gosh, I'm trying to think how long these things take so long, you know. It must have been I think it's all in 2020, so yes, absolutely, pandemic wise we went out about January 2020, December 2019, something like that, not knowing what was around the corner.
Right.
Because pandemic hit, people were out of the office, it was just so difficult to get hold of anyone. I was thinking, how are we going to do this, you know? I always pick the absolute wrong time to go out on submissions.
I know, right? You're like,
yeah,
almost there.
Aww. I gave it another go. It's 3 years now. So yeah, it must have been 3 years at that point. I was coming up to at the agency, and you know, it's awful. It's awful getting all those rejections. And then it was actually October, November time that Agora Books came forward. And what was funny was, in the meantime, because the months go by and you get no yeses, and you start to think, that's it. That's, oh gosh, I'm going to have to think of another project. I'm just going to have to tear out another piece of my heart and put it into another project. And so I did actually start writing in lockdown, a bit after I decided to step back from the business. So I was written something new over the summer, and we were revising that, me and my agent, when the Agora offer came in. So Agora is my publisher for The Undying Tower. And I was really shocked. But what was funny was, within the same week, we were sending out this new book for submission. So it was all got a bit complicated at one point, but yes, so got the trilogy, felt huge sense of relief. I'm not so useless like I thought I was. It wasn't all doomed. And that was really nice. Yes. And they wanted three books. They could see it as a trilogy. They had this great marketing plan for it. They could see that it was the sort of story that would suit a trilogy.
Yeah.
So yeah, that's how that came about.
Oh my goodness. Absolutely. And I have to be honest, I mean, I'm curious, in your, so you have a contract with your agent or your agency?
I have a contract with my agent. So, yeah.
Okay. So excellent. And then the Agora, right?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So then was it an editor that picked it up or Agora Direct?
It was an editor. So,
what's the name of your editor?
The name of my editor is Peyton Stableford. And she is amazing.
Right.
Real vision. Yeah.
She's the one I've been emailing with back and forth, I think.
She is. Yes.
Yeah. Okay. Excellent. Okay. So she picked it up. I'm curious when, because I've been listening to so many podcasts and different things about this. I don't know if you've heard of the Manuscript Academy.
No, I haven't.
Oh, you might want to check them out. They're sort of like in, you know, a similar category in a way to what you're doing with Right Mentor, which we'll talk more about later. And but what's beautiful about them is they have like a two-tier system, well, three-tier. One is they have a podcast that's free. Anyone can listen to their podcast. And they interview all sorts of people who are on the back end. And so you're just listening to agents and editors and all these amazing people talk about the backside, which is brilliant. You want to be a good partner as a writer. You want to be a great teammate, you know. You don't want to show up and have no clue. Anyways, but they're awesome. And so it's interesting because my understanding, at least over here, is that an editor might pick it up, but they still have to get it past the group of people who sit down at a table and decide whether or not to actually publish it. So is that the way it was working for you too? Like the editor picked it up, but you're still on pins and needles waiting to find out if it's going to actually get approved?
So my agent didn't tell me until it had been approved that it was going through, which is probably the best way. Now I think about it, I'm sure some people they'd be better knowing every step of the way. I didn't actually know it was with Agora. And the great thing about Agora is they're a small but mighty team. So it's less that it has to go through lots of stages, like with a huge publisher, and more that everybody kind of group reads it and everybody's talking about it at the same time. And so it's not the same sort of time scale or filter system where it might get stopped at one point, which has happened to me before. I've definitely, when you get rejection, you usually get some feedback, especially from a bigger publisher, and they will say, "Oh, I liked it, but when I passed it to the marketing team, we were struggling to look at numbers and therefore it didn't go through," whatever the reason may be. So no, at Gore, I think it was more a group decision.
And just imagine, you know, when we were looking at numbers, you're like, but you're just imagining what those numbers might be.
Yeah, exactly. You don't know. This I could be a genius.
I know this could be the next Harry Potter or whatever it is. And yeah, and you're like, oh yeah, I guess, what is it? TMI, too much information. In some ways, you might be like, you might say to your agent, okay, there's certain things I just don't need to hear.
Exactly. Yeah. You need to be able to talk to your agent about that. It's funny with TMI, my publishers asked me for a lot of input with the cover, and I was giving them all of my favorite covers and all the covers that I thought worked really well and things that I didn't think worked very well and wouldn't fit with my vision of the cover. At which point they said, "Okay, great, that's awesome. We're now going to write up a brief for the cover artist, and we're not going to show you that brief because if we showed you and you saw quite how, I guess, basic they have to break down the plot for the cover designer, I would be like, that is my precious baby. You've just described it in such a basic way." So they said they wouldn't show me that.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting. There's a great podcast I was listening to with an editor specifically, and they had asked her, "What do you want to talk about?" And she's like, "I want to talk about why this takes so long. I want writers to understand so that they don't show up and I'm not explaining to each and every one of them forever, you know, here's why it's taking so long." And it was interesting because it was like one thing that caught my attention that surprised me, you could say, was that it was edited like I think six times. Like, you know, it went to the people who would do, we're talking the editing, not conceptual thematic editing, but this is like, you know, the deeper, finer editing. And she's like, so
Each
it goes
draft.
to you for 2 weeks, and or it goes to them, and then they send it to you, and you get 2 weeks to review it. And then it goes here, and then it goes back to them, and then it goes to you. And she's like, and that repeats, you know, like four times, six times, whatever it was. And I'm like, what? And she's like, so that's 2.5 months right there. And I'm like, oh my gosh. But it also reminded me of why I think one thing self-published writers can definitely take away from that is you can't edit it too much. Because if someone's going to pick up your book and in the first page or three, they see a spelling or grammar error or two or five, you're going to lose them because their confidence in you just is blown. So it was interesting because I got an ARC, which is an advanced reader copy of The Undying Tower, and I'm reading through it, and I was seeing still, you know, there'd be like a spelling error here, or there were little things, and I was like, at one point, this was interesting. I was like, wait a minute, tick-tick-tick. I'm like, wait, she already sat down. She can't sit down again. She sat down a page and a half ago.
Yeah.
So I read everything in between it. And I'm like, did she stand up? Did she stand up? No, she didn't. And I thought to myself, this is awesome because someone's job is to find the stuff.
Yes, and then that's exactly what it is.
Yeah. And then I'm like, okay, what on earth would you do if that was your job? And you're supposed to, you know, do you just read it and hope that you're going to notice? Do you have like, so it got my whole brain spinning. This was 3 days ago, spinning and spinning about what it's like to be an editor. It's all very fascinating, I think.
Yes. So I think from what I understood when we were doing it, it goes through several edits with my agent, went through several edits with me before I gave it to my agent. And then it gets to the editor and we do what's called a developmental edit to start with, which is just a broad term thing. So things like, oh, the ending doesn't really work because it doesn't give the emotional impact of X, or this character probably doesn't need to be here and we need to cut 5,000 words. So maybe we should look at combining them with another character, like huge, big overarching things. Then you go on to your next edit, which might be like a copy edit. So that would be sort of spelling, tense, like looking closer as well at each individual line, making sure things make sense. And then what people I think don't realize is the proof edit, from what I remember, and that is sort of approving the copy. So I get it, it's all typeset. It's sent to me. It's been sent to an external proofreader who's never seen the book.
Right.
Easier for them to spot those things. And then it goes to print. So the ARC, the advanced reader copy, is somewhere in between there. They know it will have mistakes. I think it says on it something like uncorrected proof. That's what it says on those.
Oh, I totally expected
those types
it.
Of books.
Yeah. It's rare you get a chance to actually see that. It's fun. You know, it's like, oh, I'm a little bit inside the process.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm human.
Yeah. You know, I have to say, I'm really glad that you actually just went into that detail. And I hope all of the people out there who are also writing and planning to submit may have just had the same reaction that I did. Because, I mean, like I said, I've listened to hundreds of podcasts and read lots of books, but I really like those exact examples you gave, because in a way it's always dangerous as a writer if you try to be a perfectionist to the point where you never end up actually submitting something or querying something because you feel like it's never quite ready.
Yeah.
And I think that's really a good reminder that someone could pick you up, an agent could pick you up and contract with you, and an editor could buy a book, even though they're going to come back to you afterwards and say, by the way, I think that character needs to go, and I think your ending needs to be completely altered in some way to do this. Because a lot of people feel like you have to give them something that is so close to perfect that they're going to only have problems with little tiny things, and otherwise they love all of it. But there's more to what they're looking for, I think, in a person they want to work with than a perfect story. They want someone who they can work with and whose career focused and is going to be worth their investment because they're in it for the long haul, I think.
Right. I agree. I think voice comes into it and the story comes into it. And if you love something enough, then you can find. And I think the other thing as well, to be honest, with editors is they want to put their own stamp on it. They want to be involved with the development of the story. They enjoy that. They want to say, okay, and how will this story come into Agora? And Agora has a particular profile for putting out really meaty, great stories. And it sort of wants to fit into that PR, to put it in a more cynical way, but also they want to feel like that they've helped make the story come alive.
Right. Yeah.
Because it's a team effort. It's not just you anymore. It's just you when you're writing on your laptop in your bedroom. It is not you once you hand over that book. It's a whole team of people.
Well, and that's actually absolutely what I'm looking forward to. I think one of the best things I love in reading a book is flipping to the acknowledgement section. And hearing an author gush about these people who you can tell from the way they're talking about them that they really have formed, you know, authentic relationships, and they really, you know, have each other's backs. And there's that true team effort going on. It's like that's exciting to me, to feel like I'm not going to actually, I'll step out of the alone stage and I'll step into a, you know, we're working together as a team stage. I'm looking forward to that.
Yeah, no, I agree. And well, I'm certainly not looking forward to it because I'm convinced I've left off probably someone incredibly important. That's the worst bit of acknowledgements. You're right. No, it's like writing a Christmas card list and then
right.
your Auntie Joan says, why have I not had a Christmas card? And you're like, oh no,
yeah.
missed off somebody. So I am worried because there was such a huge team of people, especially when it's your debut. I think the acknowledgements are longer.
Oh.
Because there's this whole team of people that were helping just with your writing generally, and you want to thank them all.
Right.
Yeah. So it can be really tricky. So I'm very hopeful, fingers crossed, that I got everyone in.
So let's see here. I wanted to make sure for people, sometimes people can't listen to the entire show. You know, they're mm-hmm. driving or something, they'll pick it up and then they get where they're going and they're like, I have to grocery shop. So folks, you're listening to Voice of Vashon right now. And my name's March Twisdale, the producer and host of Prose, Poetry, and Purpose. And I'm interviewing Melissa Welliver, who, if you want to learn more about her, you can go to Melissa, that's with one L and two S's, Welliver, Welliver.com. It's as easy as that. And also, you can learn more about what she's doing with writementor.com. And there's that's write as in you're writing, dash mentor.com. And I actually did participate in their, I can't remember exactly what they called it, but it was their summer program. And it was really exciting. For people who are involved in the Twitter community, the writing community of Twitter, you know, you've heard about PitMad and things like that. Write Mentor is a fabulous organization, and I really love what they do. I admire it a lot. And so I'm excited for you, Melissa, that you're able to connect with them.
Yes, me too. I love Write Mentor. Yes, I actually started with them. I met their founder, Stuart White, on Twitter, writing community on Twitter, I think in about 2017, something like that. He was running sort of a little, he called it peer pitch. Like it was like a competition online where all you do is you pitch your book and your peers with the hashtag peer pitch, and your peers would help you out with the pitch and say ways to improve the pitch. And then you might read
That idea.
Yeah. So it was just like this sort of smallish thing. And I always feel like, even though probably he can think of a different place it started, for me, that was where that idea of helping other writers and helping other people came from, was that little Twitter competition that we did. And it was really fun. And
it's so
just
nice.
Grown and grown.
Because it wasn't a competition. It was it was like a collaboration.
Right. Exactly. Yeah. So that was what was so nice about it. It was the writing community coming together at various different stages and helping each other and boosting each other. That's the big thing we do at Write Mentor, is being each other's cheerleaders.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, I mean, they completely succeed at coming across that way. It feels very safe and very warm and very positive. And every step of it feels that way, actually, because there's a whole bunch of different steps and things you go through. And I mean steps like that are fun. You know, this is sort of like it's awesome. It's not like, you know, steps you have to go through. It's a very good thing. And it's interesting because, oh, my gosh, it wasn't PitMad. I'm new. I got involved in Twitter years ago. And after like a couple of weeks, like my thumbs were sore and I was confused and I just stopped. And so in January, this was funny. This is the United States of America, right? So gives context. Mm-hmm. On January 3rd, I think, I was like, I'd been listening to the podcast and reading Save the Cat, writes a novel and different things.
Right.
And somewhere along the way, I thought, oh, I just need to check out the writing community on Twitter and, you know, probably start developing that community. So on January 3rd of 2021... I decided to go on Twitter. And 3 days later, I think I can say hell on the radio. Pretty sure it's one of the words you can say. All hell broke loose. And I'm in Washington, D.C. And It's like Twitter blew up in every possible way you can imagine. And I'm just sitting here like a newbie. I was confused. I was overwhelmed.
Baptism of fire.
Oh, exactly. Thank you. Great way to put it. And of course, for me, I come from a military family, and that doesn't mean I wanted to go into the military, but it means I grew up with all the stories. You know, my granddad was shot down over Germany and spent 2 years in a POW camp, and I've got So there's despite all the things that are wrong with the country, I have this real strong sense that you, you know, you work it out within the political realm. You fix the political realm. You deal with those issues. You don't do what happened on January 6th in my ethos. So it was emotionally challenging for me. And a week later, I was overwhelmed and I thought, you know what? This is what's great about Twitter. I actually get to curate my own content. I get to decide what I want this community to be about. What do I want to be focused on? And I actually sat down for like 2 days and I had like 800 followers. And I went through and I basically almost checked out the homepage of every single person. And if they were primarily focused on anger, fury, politics, all this type of emotional stuff, I just stopped following. And I created a writing-focused Twitter community for myself. That is what comes to me. Positivity, encouragement. And I have to say, the writing community is so incredibly self-supportive. I've been really impressed.
Yeah, it's amazing, isn't it? I think with Right Mental, so we run, you were talking about, it's just called our mentoring summer program. What's really nice about that is we set up for all these, so people apply, just to explain briefly for people who don't know what it is.
Yes.
So people apply to us, we'll have about 40, 50 mentors, something like that. And these are writers at various stages of their career, giving up their summer time to help people with their manuscripts, to get them that little bit further, that little bit push along so that they can try and get an agent. They can try and apply to small presses, whatever their goal is that they want to do. And this is for kidlit specifically.
Yes. And, well, that includes YA. Let's be clear.
It does include YA. Yes. So we did that. We do that over the summer and that is our free program. And what's really nice is we set up for all the mentees. Now we've run it for a couple of years. We've learned some lessons. We set them up with a Slack group. So that's like an online community group where they can all chat. We pop them into lists on Twitter. We have a mentee liaison officer, a mentor liaison officer. I'm in a group with all the mentors. So there's all these extra levels of community going on and you could be in the same boat as people who are at the same level as you, such as the mentees, but there's also ways on Twitter to connect with your favorite authors who've maybe published 5 books and you can learn from and they can learn from you. I certainly learn from my mentee every year, things about myself and my writing. So that's what I really like about it, is as well seeing people at different levels.
Yeah. And it's a once a year thing, correct?
It is, yes. But the rest of the year, we do run some other stuff. So we have online affordable courses. We really strive to make sure that not only affordable, but very accessible for people. We want to make sure we pre-record, leave stuff up for a week. We make sure everyone's paid within the guidelines of Society of Authors. We try and put on events that may be all written in case you're maybe struggle with video, maybe struggle with your internet connection even. So people can go back and check from different time zones, or if you somebody that tires easily, then you can come back to it in your own time. So that's the biggest thing. We're trying to be as inclusive and as accessible as possible. And then the other big event we run every year is WowCon, which is our online conference that we run in September. It'll be September, is it 25th and 26th, I think, this year. So that is running again, as it usually does. So we try and make everything as inclusive as possible.
I think one of the, you know, the world was already starting to adjust and shift. You know, the internet is making a massive change on so many levels. And on so many levels, it's incredibly positive. And, you know, the last year and a half, as the world has been trying to decide how to grapple with the SARS-CoV-2 virus, and, you know, there's a lot to learn. And I think that when I was paying attention in December, which is when a lot of people, I think, first noticed that there was that doctor in Wuhan who had sort of blown a whistle that something was going on. And the Chinese government had initially been a little irritated with him for sort of going even minorly public. But it did catch people's attention. And so I remember by... Then we had someone who like flew in on January 16th into SeaTac and ended up being in the hospital for a couple of weeks, being observed, blah, blah, blah. So that was right here in Seattle where I live. So I was aware. And I remember turning to someone at one point and saying, you know, in a couple of years, we're going to have a lot of information. And that was my perspective. I'm like, this thing that's starting to happen, this was in March. And I was like, we're it's going to take a couple years to really get a grasp of this. And between now and then, there's going to be lots of information flowing, coming in. You know, we're not going to, but data grows over time, right? Mm-hmm. And I think that that perspective of this is a learning opportunity. You know, we look at what's going on, like you had mentioned, in some ways that, well, I imagine all these online resources that were competing previously with in-person events, the in-person events aren't happening temporarily. And so you guys are having to do the work to broaden your inclusivity and become more available to people. And so it's interesting to see that humans do rise to the challenge and we do find a way forward, you know, even when the ground is really bumpy underneath our feet. So I'm happy that the internet is allowing you to continue to write through Write Mentor to continue to be such a valuable resource for writers around the world.
Right. I don't think that's certainly not going to stop after this pandemic.
Right.
Fingers crossed, knock on wood, goes away. That is not going to stop. We're going to stay inclusive. It's funny. We've actually been running it. We'd run it the year before the pandemic started. We ran it last year as well. And then this year, mm-hmm. because it's all online and part of our inclusivity USP that we talk about a lot on the website. And what's interesting is a lot of people were still sort of new to Zoom. And then when they were asking questions, oh, okay, so Zoom, that's what you use. It's like, well, yes, that's what we were actually using to pre-record things before. It was quite funny.
Right.
They didn't, because we were already running an online conference. But it also gets so much more accessible for authors who have to pay. It's a lot of money sometimes with travel costs, things like that.
Absolutely.
Whereas if they can just record at home, we can get some amazing authors. We've had some amazing UK YA authors tune in and give us keynote speeches. And it's been incredible. But, you know, winners of the Orange Prize, winners of the Costa Coffee Prize, which is a big prize over here. So we've been really lucky with that and got some great people involved. And yeah, it's just more accessible for the authors, more accessible for the writers.
I mean, obviously, there's a lot of power and value in people getting together. And so I am definitely not against that. And I look forward to that being something that can also be done. But think about it. I mean, I know people who are like, they, you know, maybe they're not published yet, which means that they're, you know, still working their day job and they're writing on the side. And they might save up their money for like 2 or 3 years just to be able to go to one writing conference. And, you know, so in a way, by doing these things online, it really, it's sort of like what Airbnb did for travel. Airbnb allowed people who couldn't afford the $150 a night to stay in a hotel, you know, to be able to spend $33 to sleep in someone's spare bedroom.
Yeah, exactly.
It made
I think it's not perfect. We're always moving towards trying to be better allies. For instance, it's not just a monetary thing. There are people who are housebound. There are people who have maybe an autoimmune disease. That means it just going to a conference would be impossible, pandemic or no.
Right.
So we're always working towards trying to find different ways to make things more accessible.
Sure.
But the internet certainly helps.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, if you live on a farm, I can tell you, travel is hard because finding someone to take care of all your animals and plants while you're gone, that's expensive, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Okay, so let's talk about the Undying Tower now. The first in your 3-book series. And let's see here. So prose poetry and purpose is about lifting up and supporting writers, specifically writers who really appear to be interested in inspiring positive social change in the world, one reader and one listener at a time. I mean, that's like, you know, the umbrella goal that I have for everyone who comes onto the show. And so it's relevancy. It's all about relevancy a lot of times when it comes to fiction. And your book, I'm thinking, how about you go ahead and start us off just by explaining your personal inciting incident, what it was maybe in your life that brought this story idea to you. And then we'll go from there.
Yeah, sure. So, I did a writing master's, in creative writing at Manchester University in 2012, 2013, and met some incredible writers on that course. But I must admit, I came off the back of it and I I was a bit oversaturated with writing advice, and I didn't write for about a year. And I didn't really have any ideas. I'd brought off the course, even though I'd learned a lot about craft, and I didn't really do anything. And then I had a best friend from the course, Caroline Chisholm, and she was an incredible writer. And she sadly died from brain cancer in 2015. Wow. And when I used to talk to her about her books that she knew she wouldn't be able to finish to the standard she wanted to push them out into the world, they were already pretty high standard. She was on a fully funded PhD for creative writing. She was an amazing writer. But all I could think was, Caroline is going to kick my butt if I do not get this book written and push forward. And it's actually, the book is actually dedicated to Caroline at the beginning. I was thinking about what I wanted to write about, and thinking about a world where you don't have to worry about those sort of life out of nowhere things, right? Like cancer, those kinds of illnesses, anything to do with old age, any of those illnesses coming in, deterioration of the body, and what that world would look like. And then I thought, well, you've got vampires, you've got vampire fiction, you've got immortal fiction, but what if they weren't the ones in charge that were beautiful and sparkling in the sun and could run really fast? What if they were actually the ones that were in the minority? And would that scare people? And would people not like that? People don't like things that they don't understand that are stronger than them. They don't like it.
Right.
So that's essentially where the idea for the book came from. So in the book, the main character, Sadie, is a teenager, and she lives in a world where 5% of the population are born without the ability to age past around about the age of 25. And these people, being in the minority, are essentially put down at every possible turn. So they're only eligible for the most dangerous of jobs because they are seen as a blight on society because they're increasing population. They are punished for the smallest of crimes, usually by death, and there's no real full citizenship for them. So I wanted to think about what it would be like if you're a teenager, especially thinking about it, coming back to the YA audience, if you're thinking about what you want to do with your life, how you want to make an impact on the world. And not only are you thinking, oh gosh, I have to do really well in this subject, and I'm only 15, 16 years old, because if I don't, I'll ruin the rest of my life. And I have to choose now. But to think if that life was 100 years, 1,000 years long, and you're still feeling that way, what would that feel like? So that's where the idea for the book came from.
Right. Wow. I mean, I totally get that, that feeling that, you know, your friend lost the opportunity and you're still here and still have it. And so you don't want to waste that.
Right. Exactly. That's exactly how it feels.
Yeah. I totally get that. There's a couple of times where I've had a couple of health issues. I've been working on my novel series for 10 years, putting on the back burner when I would take care of, you know, things with my family and stuff. And a couple of times I had a couple of health scares. And it was interesting. In both situations, like, the first thing I thought of was, I haven't finished my book. And I remember being like, wow, I'm like in the ER with this massively swollen arm, and I'm thinking they might have to amputate my hand. And the first thought I have is not any of these other things, but how am I going to finish my book if I can only write with one hand? And then that's what made me realize, oh, this book really, really, really does matter to me, you know?
And you're a writer. So, of course, it's really, really important to you.
Yeah. But I don't think, since it was always going on the back burner, and my children and their friends and my family and the garden and everything, that was always my priority, you know, my community was my priority. But I was like, I am actually putting on the back burner this thing that I really, really believe in. And now the kids are older, so I'm like, I'm a little bit more free to focus, which is brilliant. But okay, all right. I just think that your premise is, I love that you did that. You sort of did a spin. You're like, let's not make them this, you know, the super powerful, you know, ones. Let's actually flip it. And so the undying element really does cause people to do that thing that we need to do, I think, which is think about what makes life worth living. And death is, for most of us, apparently not for the undying, but death is this unavoidable thing. It's going to happen. And yet it seems like we, in our culture over here, at least, I don't know your part of the West, it feels to me like there's not a lot of comfort around this unavoidable thing that's going to happen to all of us.
Right. Yeah. I think that's something I definitely found explored itself in the book, if that makes sense. So because I'd come up with, this is the type of book that I'd come up with, a what if idea. So the what if idea was that these people don't live forever and it's only a small percentage of the population. So what was nice about the world building, especially with it being speculative fiction, so it's sort of based in the future of our own world,
right,
is that it kind of started putting itself together. So I was, one of my first things I was thinking was, if there are people who don't have to die, what would that do to people's sense of the afterlife? Whether it be religious or not, what is that sense of what happens when you die? If some people don't die, mm-hmm. that would shake every core value you have. And that is one of the comforting things we take or try and form around death, right? Is what, maybe what, and I was also thinking about, of course, it has a parallel with what you leave behind. If you say, aren't religious, I'm not particularly religious, what would I leave behind? So I was thinking about this book, I was thinking about Caroline, what could she leave behind when she's gone? So yeah, I think the idea of death, and if some people can avoid it, it actually highlights other people's fear of death, mm-hmm. Definitely fed into the book a lot.
Wow, I think that's really interesting. You're right, because there is the religious or the anti-religion component in, and I think we see historically that in many cases, when you have a more controlling system of power in place, and I hesitate to use the word government because it can be a non-governmental entity that has power, but it seems like, you know, the Soviet Union, I think, sort of in a way, I don't know if they legalized religion, but they were definitely, seemed anti. And then I think you've got North Korea is pretty much harsh on anyone that has a religion outside of worshiping the leader of North Korea. And so mm-hmm. it's interesting. You did pull that in. What was it that made you want to, or why did you think it made sense for the protectorate to be so harshly against religion?
Yeah. So one of the big things I did when, and I think anyone lucky enough to get an ARC got a little sense of this. So I put together, when I sent the book on submission, a little packet of materials that I made when I was world building.
Yeah.
And one of them was, what would a constitution look like if you formed a new country out of the ashes of what was going on? So there's a little bit of background in the book, but essentially we're a couple of decades past the discovery of these people that live for a long time. When the book's happening, what happened before that in the immediate aftermath was this total breakdown of civilization, with the thought of these people that don't die, with the fact that overpopulation would boom so fast, right, with people that aren't actually dying. And so people being born aren't filling the spaces of people who are gone.
Right.
And I had the idea of these religious wars. And so my thought was, what would perhaps a new government party coming out of, it's essentially set in the UK, but they've changed the name of everything.
Right.
What would they think needs to be left out to make the most harmonious state? To them, they'll think it's harmonious. To us, right, of course, it's massive cutting of freedoms. And that's, I think, quite often, you were talking about Russia and communism, and I think quite often they think they're doing a good thing, but it's not. So they're, one of the rules in the constitution of the Avalonia zone, where the book is set, which is now the UK, in the future it's the Avalonia zone, is that there is no religion allowed. It is completely banned. We're not going to talk about the afterlife. We're not going to talk about it. Mm-hmm. Similarly, I knew I had to get rid of the royal family because they're God anointed. So I had to get rid of the words United Kingdom. Again, this all fed into the world building and kind of felt natural mm-hmm. progression. So that was where that came from.
Right. Right. So, and then, obviously overpopulation is definitely something that people are thinking about right now. And then that comes into the story as well. What sort of message or ideas are you hoping to bring up in the minds of your readers, not in order to provide an answer, but to give them a springboard to jump off of into their own thoughts about the topic?
Yeah, that's a really good question. I think, especially for my young readers, because it's a YA novel, I want young people to realize that the most important thing is not sticking to a plan that has to stick forever and nothing will change. And you must live through that. And you must pick the subjects you need to pick and please your parents and then nail that down and then never change your mind from the age of 15, 16, which is what it is in the UK, essentially, is when you start narrowing down those subjects as an example. Mm-hmm. And I also wanted young people to feel empowered that they're the ones that are going to be here in the future. And they're the ones that are going to be the leaders of tomorrow. Right. So they need to, whilst thinking about the future, they also need to feel flexible and feel powerful and take back that power for themselves. So I think that's a huge theme in the book. Even when faced with what feels like the whole world is against you, if you know what's right, you have to push through what you think or what you've been taught, and you have to push through for what's right.
Mm-hmm. You know, it's interesting. I have some friends who are men, and they've gotten, okay, I have a lot of friends that are men, but I have some friends who aren't men, who are like late 50s and 60s. So they've been around for a while. They've right. Let's say they've matured and or they've, what happens to wine? They've aged like a fine wine. Okay. And one of the things that I'm noticing a lot of them are saying is they're reflecting on human history, long term, but also recent. And a lot of them are like, you know what? We, as the males of this species, don't seem to really necessarily be very successful at the creation of a peaceful, harmonious, cooperative society. And then right. they'll say, the women need to take over.
Yeah.
And I'm like, wait a minute. Wait. Y'all like screwed it up for thousands of years. And like now we get to clean up the mess. I was like, well, yeah, I think we would do a better job maybe. But, you know, you can't just like, you know, I'm like, yeah, you have to stay engaged. You have to also actually make amends or participate or change and encourage other younger men to, you know, arrive where you have arrived a little sooner. So the other thing I also notice and is that there's, and I'm wondering if this is going on where you live in the world, is mm-hmm. that I feel as a mother of two kids who are this coming week and a half, they're going to turn 20 and 23, my sons. And I've known them, I've known their friends. And when you have kids, they tend to have, especially if you're homeschooling, they tend to have a broad age range of friends. They're not just their mm-hmm. own school or class level. And so for the last, since 2008, when we had the economic collapse, I've been watching all of these young people sort of struggling to grapple with the consequences of the previous generations and trying to find a new pathway forward that's not exactly what their parents and their aunts and uncles did. The right. world is not the same as it was in the 70s or the 80s or even the early 90s. It's very different. And what's interesting is that there's a lot of hand-wringing and wailing and flailing about in the older generations that are literally predicting gloom and doom. We're, you know, if we don't fix climate change in the next 12 years, 8 years, 6 years, it's getting shorter, the world's just going to end, all humanity will die. And I'm sitting here watching this wailing thing happening with all these older people, and the children are observing it. And there's this right. attitude of, well, the kids are going to fix it. You know, they're more savvy than we are. They know what's going on. Like, we didn't realize back in the 80s or 90s that maybe we were part of the problem. No, we were clueless. And these kids understand, so it's their job to fix it now. So whether men are saying women need to take over or the adults are saying, you know, the kids have to save us all, you know, it seems to be like this foisting off of responsibility onto especially the youth. So mm-hmm. you're writing in dystopia and you're trying to empower young people. And I love how that came forward constantly in your YA novel. What are your thoughts in general in the real world after someone finishes reading your book or whatever? What would you like to encourage them to feel empowered about or in a way in which they cannot necessarily absorb the there's nothing we can do attitude.
Yeah, I think even looking at in recent years with young heroes coming up like Greta Thunberg and speaking out about her truth and speaking out for what she knows. I think there's a huge theme in the book with the main character Sadie in that she wants to shy away from responsibility or thinking too much about what's going on around her. And for a large portion of the book, without dropping any spoilers, she's in a privileged position and she thinks back to a privileged position and she ends up in an unprivileged position. And she's essentially given time to think about how she handled herself when she was in that privileged position, when she did have that voice, when it's perhaps not as loud as the protector, it's not as loud as the adults, but she had something, she had a little bit of power. Mm-hmm. And I think the main thing I'd like young people to go away with isn't necessarily thinking about a specific topic. I like to discuss topics in my books, but I don't want to be preachy about it or tell you what to think. I think it's generally, think about how you can use your voice. Is there ever a situation where you can use your voice to make something better, even if it's that one small thing? You don't have to be Greta Thunberg on TV in the UN. Mm-hmm. She's amazing, but you don't have to be that. There will be something there every day, prejudices happening all around us. Mm-hmm. That I certainly based a lot of the smaller scenes in the book on things I've seen, whether it be on the news, whether it be in person, as we go back out into the world after this pandemic. And there will be things that people are thinking about more. And I'd like you to think, what can I do to help make this better and mm-hmm. be safe? Even if it's go home and sign a petition, even if it just think, what is it you could do instead of just walking away or thinking, well, it's not me doing it, I should just leave this alone. If you see an injustice, think about what you could do to make that better.
Right. Mm-hmm. Right. There's that idea they have in schools, at least on this side of the Atlantic, where they're like, there's no stupid question. It's something you say to students in order to try to encourage them to be brave enough to raise their hand and ask a question, even though they're expecting 25 kids to start laughing at them. Right.
Okay.
And you're trying to overcome that. And I think another way to look at that is that you're never the only uncomfortable bystander.
Right.
If you're standing, you know, the bully depends upon the bystander. The bystanders are the ones that have the real power, because if they all stand up and say to the one or two bullies, you know, that's not cool, you need to stop that, then the bullies can't do what they're doing.
Exactly. They lose that power.
Yeah. And when you stand up and say, hey, you need to stop this, the 12 people around you who are thinking that but are too scared to speak up are going to feel a little bit more comfortable saying, you need to stop this. And then another person says it and another person says it. But sometimes you have to be the one to get the ball rolling.
Exactly. Right. Exactly. So I think that's definitely a major theme is in the book is, I've been told by a couple of people, the main character isn't necessarily likable at the beginning of the book, and that's okay.
Yeah.
It's not about being likable. Hopefully she's more likable by the end of the book, and she has that character arc that lots of characters have, and the heroic arc and stuff like that.
Yeah.
Speaking of Save the Cat. But so I'm hoping people will come away thinking, you know what, just because I'm like this today, tomorrow's a new day, I can think more, I can look more, I can, there's a lot of stuff about teenagers being selfish, and I think it's actually really lazy rhetoric. I don't think teenagers are selfish. I think they think a lot about the world around them. They just feel scared to speak up.
Yeah, or they don't feel confident that they know enough about the world yet to be able to say something that isn't going to get scoffed at. Because of course the adults do such a good job of rolling their eyes and saying, yeah, well, you know, wait a few years and then you'll understand it better. I mean, we really do sort of shut them down.
Exactly.
Yeah. Melissa, thank you so much for taking some time out of your evening way over there on the other side of the Atlantic to join me here on Prose, Poetry, and Purpose.
Oh, thank you so much for having me. I've had a great time.
Yeah. And I just really enjoyed your book. When is the second book slated to come out?
I believe, although this is one of those publishing floating things that can change any time, for instance, as another pandemic. I believe the same time next year. So it should be autumn, fall next year should be book two, and then the same for book three.
Oh, well, congratulations. I mean, of course, that's a little intense for you on the writing side, but I think for readers, you know, to only have to wait a year in between books is really, really nice.
Yes. Yeah. It's intense, but I think it's a good type of intense. This is a story I feel like has scope for three books. I live inside this world in my head. So I'm good. I promise I'll get it out on time.
Well, and like I was saying earlier, I'm really glad they gave you a full trilogy for this, because like I said, I was getting maybe three quarters of the way through and I'm thinking, oh, this is definitely got, like, there's plenty of room to play in this world. And I have to say, you were not preachy at all. So if you had any concerns about that, definitely didn't
<That's>
happen.
Good.
Yeah. All right. Well, thank you again. And I hope you stay safe, healthy, and congrats on everything that's going well in your life right now.
Oh, thank you so much. And yes, do stay safe. Hope everyone stays safe at this difficult time that we're nearly through. Fingers crossed.
I know. Well, yep. We are strong. We will persevere together.
Exactly.